Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Stuart Savosky, who is the author of Advanced Spiritual Intimacy, The Yoga of Deep Tantric Sensuality. This book is very appropriate for those of us who are interested in health, as sexuality and spiritual development are both very great important aspects of health, and we'll be talking about that today. And welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you.
Would you mind giving our audience a little bit of your background? I understand that you have degrees in religion and psychology from Princeton University and the California Institute of Integral Studies.
Right. And actually, before that, I'm sort of a child of the 60s. And I begin my biography with finding myself as a high school student in one of the first schools in the North to be integrated, and being the student body president. And even at an early age, sensing, you know, a role of that we have to make things better than what we were born into. So I was involved in the integration of a high school at the age of 17 as a student leader. And then after that, at Princeton, you know, the whole anti-war movement was in full bloom. And I had already been a religion major. And like a lot of millions of us, you know, we had a kind of a psychedelic awakening. In which, you know, you could take LSD, as Ram Dass was leading us, someone who you were saying that you've helped as well with the interviews and so on. But, you know, what happened is people immediately felt that war was unnecessary from being quickly elevated into a higher state of consciousness, and kind of saw it as just a bad habit. Vengeance that would just go on endlessly, or you could just kind of step out of it. And so that gave way by the time I left college, when I took my first yoga class around 1972 or one, I think it must have been. And that was amazing, because, as I think millions of people now know, 40 years later, a yoga class can give you a feeling, I wouldn't say like launching you like an LSD trip, but you've really realized that we're sort of, as a culture, stuck at a lower level of functioning than we have to be, and that yoga is not just another form of exercise. It's much deeper. So I just did every single thing that my yoga teachers would tell me, probably the most radical, at least to the outsider, was 2 years into it, I met a guru, and he was saying, if you want to get beyond Freud, you're going to have to change everything in your life and marry yoga. And his suggestion was a year and a quarter of marrying yoga 100%, which meant that this was the ancient way that all yogis lived their yoga in India for 4,000 or 5,000 years, if not more, is the movements of yoga became a love affair. And so everything else was working really well. So I took this vow, which in the Sanskrit is called brahmacharya, or literally marrying God, and marrying the energy of God. And then it was automatic. I had no choice. My body would move automatically. And it felt like I had to try to give language to it, which I started my research back then, and felt it to be a puberty. And then I saw that it was happening in all kinds of religions, particularly the ones where your body would move, the charismatic religions.
Right. And the Shakers and that
yeah,
kind of
all
thing.
These people. Yeah. Yeah, the voodoo, the Dionysian revels from the ancient Greek times, and even Elvis Presley was more or less shaking, but I could see it. It was the teenage puberty, and it changed the world in itself. His shaking, you know, it made the youth culture be prominent among all others. So this spinal puberty that in Sanskrit would be called Kundalini awakening was awakening, firstly, this yogic practice, but it was much more like a love affair. And frankly, when I see how yoga is taught today, I make the comparison that it looks like either you could say couples having romantic relation, but they're not having any juice. They're not having sexual connection compared to this, what I can use the word, but in a very simple sense, that I was celibate. I was projecting all of my energy into the yoga, getting up at 4 a.m. to be with the beloved. And so it was all coming to life. But the reason I wrote the book was after 30, 40 years of this, I stopped counting in a way, I could see that it wasn't that well known.
No, it isn't.
That's right. Translating it into couples practices, or I should say revealing the tantra that I also didn't see described anywhere in Margot Anand's book, who's actually a friend of mine, and other people. And that was because they didn't precede their erotic tantra with this glandular transformation that only comes, and you can read it in the text. They don't say you can just jump in. In fact, if you do in America, you really just get a kind of a more meditative type of sex. But tantra is when the glands change their secretions. And that is like puberty. You really can't make a five-year-old have puberty. So it was probably 20 years into it that I started feeling that my glands were really changing in my mid-40s. And then the glands become mildly psychedelic themselves, or with that new term would be entheogenic. The chemistry, and then I started seeing the science was corroborating. Melatonin,
DMT, serotonin,
all these chemistries are natural to the body, and how can they be awakened? They all come from the pineal, third eye, the goal of yoga, this chakra in the center of the mind. So it was all falling together, and then the texts having to do with coupled eroticism, where you share secretions, but in a very devotional way, otherwise it doesn't really happen. Anybody can kiss and so on. But in this changed body, it gives rise to these incredibly beautiful states. So that's in a nutshell. I probably skipped over some things if you wanted to ask about my background from high school to right now.
Well, thank you. It seems that, well, probably most of our listeners have experienced falling in love. I mean, that's fairly common. But what I'm thinking and what I'm trying to bring through with this, introduction to your work is that the falling in love, that is so, I guess known to most of us, requires another person, and then, of course, if that person leaves, or if the person dies, or other changes occur, then we experience a vacuum of the opposite of falling in love, which is more isolation and, you know, that sort of thing. So you're still in duality. But this, presents a way for either individually or couples to experience the same energy, and I think that energy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that energy is the alignment of the she's, so that the energy of God can come down and then start the glandular process and, you know, the pineal and the DMT and all of the things that you're talking about can start that process, and then we can permanently be in that state of being in love. Is that accurate, what I'm saying?
That's, beautifully said, and I hope you are able to tell that to many, many people as well, because that's the message I hope of the new sexual revolution, of this full-bodied puberty, where all the bodies that yoga describes, these koshas or shes, get to mature. And what's interesting is that this kind of reveals the hidden side of traditional paths of love, like till death do you part,
right.
you know, that scares the modern audience because we were only given a map to the teenage puberty. And mm-hmm. divorce rates went up, of course, as that became the common knowledge because it wasn't enough of a map. So desire, people would run out of desire or blame each other for not making each other feel good instead of mm-hmm. the lifelong commitment that was taught. But it got kind of even more confusing because it seemed like a should rather than a promise of some golden land at the end of 40 years of marriage, where all these bodies come online. They all are maturing your whole lifetime. And the sharing of secretions, whether kissing or what I call this kind of oral cathedral eroticism, where you're soaking in each other's hormones and energies mm-hmm. and love. Maybe it relates to oxytocin because that's a molecule that science has found that bonds people it endlessly. And then it shows mm-hmm. why people suffer so much when the relationship breaks down. Because I don't think of it as just the relationship. It's that they're now out of harmony with the universe, the way it is set mm-hmm. up for the male and the female, or for gay people, that they can do it with the same gender. But the way you're set up is not just to have a little romantic life, which is beautiful, but literally as a path to full maturation and to these high states of connecting to the source. And so when you have a little fight, it's like somebody has taken away your connection to the path of into God.
Yeah, and that's why you end up with depression, isolation. You know, even one of my family members through marriage, my brother's marriage, my sister-in-law's brother was in high school and broke up with his high school sweetheart and then committed suicide in high school. I mean, you know, that really impacted me. It really made me understand that, you know, this kind of withdrawal mm-hmm. of this energy could be devastating.
You know, and, that's where, you know, when we hear the romantic love stories, I think they're a signal. Where they're tragic is that how high the stakes are. And so it starts to, I think, cause a whole turning, away from the kind of ironies about sex and our whole mm-hmm. media culture with TV shows, a very glib sense of relationship. And you almost have to blend the new age kind of thinking with very conservative ideology of lifelong commitment, because mm-hmm. These breakups that happen, they point to that we start to not be able to live without this other person, and mm-hmm. we may be able to adapt, but the adaptations are almost worse in an insidious way, because people create prenuptials, for example, mm-hmm. as they're getting married, they're making a legal contract for the divorce. This happens,
You're projecting an outcome.
You know, people are rejecting and selecting each other by the dozens every week on these dating sites. And you see that everybody's skittish because the stakes are so high. We have no map to really deliver on how to make it go well. That's what I wrote about. So that you, and then it's a matter of feeling primarily. Another aspect of it is fertility. That I try to make the analogy that the bond that a new mom will feel with her baby at birth and a father, that is the example that's the most alive still. That we really are bonded to each other and need each other, and we grow together and as these higher eroticisms awaken beyond Freud, that it all flips around. You want to be married to the person as long as possible, and the gratifications are equal to the task, both at daily life, because it does change your state of consciousness, not just in bed where, you know, the worship, you could call it, takes place. And you see, I think of it a bit like global warming. You see all the signs of ways we've misused the environment, and nothing's going to change until we stop doing that. Thomas Kuhn, if you've read his material, he made the word paradigm famous. That you have a worldview that, for example, when Copernicus was around centuries ago, he calculated that it was the sun in the center of our system of planets, when the church was teaching for hundreds of years that it was the earth,
right?
For theological reasons. And he couldn't help it. He kept calculating it. And finally, the maps were so inaccurate of trying to make the earth in the center based on how the observations were.
It just didn't work.
It didn't work anymore.
It didn't work at all.
And so Copernicus, he was frightened. He waited 40 years because he was afraid of being ostracized from his profession in the church, which had condemned people for heresy for such things.
Right.
But he said it anyway. What I'm saying is, this Freudian theory, this sexual liberation, is running to its end. We see it in the New York Times just yesterday. A very liberal woman was blogging that her abortion was not that great.
And she
was saying, as a feminist, she was very proud of her abortion on the way to the clinic. And even though she had a Middle Eastern cab driver who said, please don't do it. I'll pay for your baby's upkeep for the rest of your baby's life.
Oh, my goodness.
Her. Yeah, it's an amazing blog. And there are many other signs like this.
Yeah.
The contraception debate, the polarization of the left and the right. We can't understand each other. How could it be so different about the zygote, for example? Is it a human or does it count? How come we're even having a debate about when does life begin? It's for one reason. It's to protect this form of sexuality that Freud gave us that was only up to the teenage puberty. And we're all running around living according to it and bumping into the limits of that map.
There's another worldview that I'd like to also mention at this time, and that's the worldview that because many of us reincarnate and come back and marry again and again the same person, we find each other, we get married, or we come back and we marry the person that may have killed us in a previous life to try to work things out. If you see things from a much, much larger standpoint outside of space and time, there's a lot going on with these soul contracts. And if you can understand the soul contracts, then a lot of the crazy things that occur in life make a lot more sense. And I think that eventually, when we get out of puberty, like you say, we're going to be able to look at the big picture, the picture across lifetimes. I think that's extremely important.
It's not every radio show that I talk to my interviewer who has this broad of a context, and so you allow me to open up to this is probably the most mysterious aspect of Indian and many other traditions, we keep being reincarnated until we complete what's possible on the earth plane, and all the levels are matured. At the very least, we identify that the soul is a very, very durable thing, and we don't live like a little ego, which feels hurt at every slight, and it gets angry and creates all kinds of havoc. We see it as Freud said, it's the genital, he called it this, he called it the genital primacy ego. And we're just talking about a pineal primacy ego. So marriage is, like you say, a karmic background has always been thought of as to be compared with dharma. Karma or side effects of not being in harmony with the whole will ripple on and on and on, whether in wars, as we see in some groups that go on endlessly, the Israeli and Palestinian problem just endlessly echoing back and forth until some breakthrough happens. As I wrote about with Jimmy Carter's negotiation of the Egyptian peace accords, the Camp David peace accords, where they looked at baby pictures, Begin, Sadat, And Carter, at the last effort of trying to bring about a peace back in, I think it was 77, he's all of a sudden, Menachem Begin starts crying, looking at pictures.
That was very smart of Jimmy Carter to do that. That was probably divinely guided, I would imagine.
A saintly kind of a guy who could only try such a thing. And so that's where the dharma of protecting the seed. We all have babies,
right.
Children. You get a picture of that in the right moment. History will change, and it always does. The karma, the karma of the Jews and the Arabs and the Egyptians goes way back. It's not that great. But with that reconnecting with dharma, the order of the universe, the protection, it's a divine responsibility that adults take care of their young. And,
right.
And that's also when you kill a child, an eye for an eye goes back a long ways too, and that
right.
creates this karma. And like you say, in reincarnation, you may be coming back to work something out, but what I'm kind of saying is that Western psychology can barely deal beyond listening to each other's anguish, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy is extremely, it's better than just reacting to each other. It's to hear,
right.
Wow, I really hurt you. Or even in last lifetime, I really hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm getting it. Instead of, well, what the hell with you? Well, you really hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And then
right.
the other one says, well, but you hurt me first and you did this and that, you know. And that's the typical.
Well, you know, it can just go on forever if you don't realize that it takes both of you to stop that, you know.
And have something to replace it with that makes
right.
the pain even deeper initially.
Yeah.
Once people realize that what they're missing, not only do they suffer from the stone throwing that's been going on, and as you know, I've been a marriage therapist for 40 years. I'm 65.
Right.
I've been doing
right.
this a long time. Close to 6,000 couples all over the world. Is the real suffering is that they're missing out. And they don't even know what they're missing, really. They've become so consumed with the fighting or the affairs or whatever is going on that they think that's the 100% of their problem. They forget even that what they're missing is what God, you could say, or the universe has set out for us, which is this, you could call it Shiva Shakti, or a wonderful marriage with this psychedelic eroticism that the deities get to enjoy. And people don't even, so you give them a little taste. The oddest thing is that it's not that very far away, I have found, in marriage counseling. If you just have people talk about what they've ever loved about each other, they start to get into the dharma, you know, the harmony with
right.
the universe, and then they feel the gap. You know, that's what we once had, and now look where we are. And then they can become partners in getting back on the path.
Right, right. I want to take a minute now and have you give your contact information if any of the audience wants to go on the web and take a look at your website.
Sure. You know, you can search me best with Google my name, STUARTSOVATSKY, Stuart Sovatsky. You, of course, can email me directly at STUARTCS1@comcast.net. And my book, Advanced Spiritual Intimacy, is now it's coming out on the web. It's been out about a month now. You can find out about that, too.
I want to explain to our audience who may not understand what two words, Tantra and then Kundalini. I think, as you probably know as a counselor, a lot of Westerners don't know the meaning of either of those words, and it might be a... Good to explain that.
Sure. As a preface, I would say that you have to get a sense that many cultures developed independent of one another. And to really get into the concept of Kundalini, you have two sides to that question. One is that we'll find similar things happening in a phenomenon with different names around the world. Tummo in Tibetan, or Shekinah, or the divine spirit in Judaism, the Holy Ghost in various Christian traditions. In davening is a form in Judaism too, where the praying people start rocking from their spines. In Islam, zikr, when the spine rocks in exactly the same way as the Jewish davening of prayer. You see it all around the world, this attempt of energy traveling up the spine, the caduceus in medical science as a symbol of the two snakes curving around usually a sword, but it's of the spine. Ultimately, you see signs of this one phenomenon all around the world in different traditions. Plato talked about the union of the male and the female, which is another aspect of Kundalini, that we're looking for our missing half. Lots of signs. So even as we approach the word Kundalini, I wanted to put it in the context that it sounds pretty strange, but it's all over in many different religions and traditions. But what I think we see in the Indian tradition is they articulated the details of this process in the most detailed way, and it really means literally the energy of gestation. It's usually just translated as mother energy or evolutionary energy, but it has a feminine connotation, and not only specifically the developmental aspect. So when we're conceived, for the mother Kundalini is the most active in making us have a human body, and then it starts to recede between the eighth and ninth month of gestation. And prana is the name that's given to the basic life energy, because we slow down our maturation around the eighth to ninth month, and then are born. And what's interesting is labor contractions. Where do they come from? Where, you know, in the menstrual cycle.
It's hormonal, though, isn't it? Because they give Pitocin to induce labor, so it must be that hormone.
Exactly. So we have correlates, names for the effects of this energy. As soon as the baby is a certain size, the uterus knows that it has to start creating birth contractions.
Right.
The other way around is that the baby needs to come out, and so it evokes birth contractions. So both people, mom and the being born baby, are completely synchronized, and the baby starts moving, and the birth contractions happen. That's where Kundalini is just a high or low level, you could call it, of Kundalini. They call it pranotana, or high-level prana, which is the basic life energy. It's very close in between those two terms, Kundalini or high-level prana. But then the baby's born, and for the first number of years, couple years, you know, it's growing at a very fast rate. But more and more from age 2, 3, 4, 5 on, prana is the name of the ordinary energy that is like what underlies chi. The same energy that we would call qi and that acupuncture deals with. Interestingly, science can't explain acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good practical way of looking at things. The insurance companies don't care if science can explain
they
how
they want to know if it works.
Because it works. And it works much more cheaply than medicine. So they'll go where the cheap cure is. They don't care about science. Science may worry and fret that they can't explain acupuncture, and doctors, some have had a hard time prescribing it, but others take the risk and prescribe it, and insurance companies will pay. So we know that qi, even though it can't be measured, is covered by insurance policies. So that's how the world changes often, is if companies can, you know, if it's a cheaper way to help people, they'll go for it, way ahead of science. So Kundalini is an even deeper level of qi. And what happens in India, you could say, to use that as an example, some babies, the way babies move, infants, they're not moving willfully. The gestation process is continuing, and they jolt and move like they're shaking almost. And some children never stop doing that. And they were in India allowed to keep doing that instead of taking up the family business, that was inherited, from parent to child, becoming a weaver or a farmer or a sculptor or whatever, and they were called yogis, the children who would keep moving on and on. because the Kundalini energy was maturing their bodies way beyond the average person. And this probably is taps into reincarnation. They were understood as being souls that were, had been doing this for many births.
Right.
And should be allowed to do this special life of the saint. And same thing happened in the West. John the Baptist, with his, he will baptize you with fire. Talking about Christ, the fire baptism is another way that this Kundalini is active in saints that are more mature, you could say. They've had many more births following the Dharma rather than getting caught up in the karma of their difficulties or their history. And they matured bodies that were radiators of this natural energy that helped the whole culture. And, you know, so Kundalini is a name for this energy, except, like I'm saying, in Indian thought, it's mapped out. So all Hatha Yoga asanas were originally this ecstatic movement of energy causing the body to go into a headstand. Why? Because they thought of it, that's how the body prays to the pineal gland. It had nothing to do with health. Health is a secondary Western concept. You wouldn't say that Catholics kneel before Jesus' crucifix in order to stretch their knees. It would seem a little silly. You would say out of devotion to a deity that sacrificed in order to love his enemies, it makes us feel awe and we fall to our knees. So all the asanas are different ways that this puberty happens, that this devotion to the unfolding of the mother energy, the full gestation. And originally, some people would have all the yoga meditation. And as I say, it's, you find it in all the different religions, the singing, nigun in Hebrew, which is spontaneous singing, qawwali, this quivering type of singing in the Islamic world, all different forms of ways of being that are a little bit outside of what you could do to earn a living in, you know, learning a trade. Your body is freed up from taking on, learning certain skills and is more into this natural mode of being. And that's what Kundalini is saying is that in terms of reincarnation, we all have a place to be. You can't push your maturation too much more than what you were born into.
You can't open a rose with a hammer.
It unfolds. But, you know, in my case, a guru came and whispered a mantra in my ear, and I became completely awake to this higher dharma. And, and part of my puzzle definitely is, how do I share it with people? I did mainly, getting it into prisons, getting yoga into prisons. I was the first person to ever get yoga into a youth prison in the early 70s, and then helping couples, trying to find a way to help have this mother raise our expectations about what is possible.
Well, I want to emphasize to the audience, too, that I presented a couple of times at the Kundalini Research Network, and so I've been studying Kundalini, fairly extensively, and the premature awakening of Kundalini causes some fairly significant neurological problems. So people who do Kundalini yoga and other practices unsupervised can get into trouble medically. And so I would encourage people that are going to look into this to do it with the help of a counselor such as yourself or someone else who has some experience, because people don't realize how powerful this energy, once it starts moving, actually is. And there's been many instances. In fact, I've had patients come here. I'm a plastic surgeon, but I've had patients come to me with Kundalini awakening emergencies where they were shaking so hard they couldn't drive a car. You know, think about that. You know, it can be very impressive when you see it clinically. So just a warning to people, this isn't something you just buy a book and start doing. It's a... You need teachers, you need guides to do this.
And you're right, you almost need a whole cultural plastic surgery. You have to transform, have available a whole culture. And I'm glad that your awareness is in your profession is probably sparing many people a misdiagnosis, that my predecessor, Lee Sinella, was an ophthalmologist, and he saw the same thing back in the mid-70s, that people with these awakenings looked a lot like the people that were being psychiatrically hospitalized. They looked shaking and all these things that he saw.
Right.
And he began this thing called spiritual emergence. So, if you have and when I meet people, the first thing I try to do is we have to do it, obviously, building a relationship. But I bow to the client. I say, if you were bowed to when you initially had this awakening as a very holy phenomenon, that would steady you tremendously. And you would have a place in the world that would make sense to you. And so you would not fill your body with adrenaline of that other people would be fearing for your well-being. And then you'd have, we're trying to create at least a little island for people who do have an awakening with a counselor who will be not pathologizing them. And also that's just the beginning to honor a person. And for them to feel honored, then their chemistry starts going towards oxytocin and the good chemistries. And then their awakening goes really well. So it's that initial first step that, and I've written about this extensively. In fact, my colleagues, we did get the DSM-4 to change. The DSM-3 had a lot of these, what they were calling depersonalization disorders. Mm-hmm. They were all only one, and they were all bad. And we were bringing to their attention that there's another kind, which is very good. And so the DSM-4 changed.
That's great.
And around the 2000 and something, after 20 years. So, the medical world is aware that in other cultures, you can't just use the Eurocentric worldview and a very scientific worldview to assess what people from other cultures feel is a good thing. Like you're beyond the ego, and you feel it doesn't happen all at once like a teenager. I mean, no one would say, oh my God, these teenagers, they don't think they're a child anymore. What are they doing? That they were 10 years old and now they're trying to act like they know everything. We know that's normal transition from a child identity to a teenage and then an adult identity.
Right.
And in the West, it's made a big giant thing of the teenage years because of the teenage puberty is as far as we understand. Mm-hmm. But the soul identity, it doesn't happen overnight. And even in the best of circumstances, Christ being a great example, he had this very, some would say, the most complete awakening in the Western history, of that he was a child of God, and that he didn't have to buy into any bad karma. He could even die forgiving people who were attacking him. And the world has not been able to forget that. So everyone has had some issue in this awakening, that it's not so simple because it goes on and on and on. Helping people with that initial step where they don't think they're crazy. Thinking you're crazy is almost enough to make you go crazy because the chemistry is so frightening. And then you frighten the people around you. They don't want to take a risk. They'll take you to an ER. And the ER physicians, they don't want to take a risk. What are they going to do? Kundalini awakening diagnosis?
Right.
30 years, like I say, 20, 30 years ago, didn't even exist. Now it's a little bit in the public consciousness, the medical consciousness, a little bit. So, you can take a risk and say, I think you should go take yoga classes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then the problem is there's 14 million people doing yoga and probably 100,000 yoga teachers. But very few of them have the backing, the depth that I was lucky enough from day one. This brahmacharya, that where your body goes through changes that have been the core of yoga. And that makes you have an energy field that is extremely helpful to people with these awakenings. Because, the sexual energy is not fully mature. And sometimes I just would chant mantras with someone, But the my voice has got 30 years of this type of brahmacharya, this glandular transformation. And it, when you look at the scriptures, it was assumed for at least 3,000 to 5,000 years that when you would go for help with Kundalini or go for training, that your teacher had been living this way. And in India, it's not that remarkable. And it's maybe harder in modern times because of the effects of Freudian psychology in modern culture, that the gurus too are shaken. But in my case, the positive experiences were so great that I could take it to a very high degree. And that, again, it adds more of that healing, guiding energy for people who really, really do need it at that time.
I think people also need to remember, and I think we don't remember this, except maybe, you know, when we have a baby or when we are involved in family life, that sexual energy is creative energy. It's probably our closest common bond for the creative energy that makes us at least potentially able to bond with the higher, you know, higher forces, God, consciousness, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So to really understand that we all have the ability to participate in this, whether it be, you know, with other people, with ourselves, with, you know, in context of Kundalini yoga or another sacred practice. It's something that we all have in common. It's something that we all, we can honor that in each other. And I think that's what, you know, tantric sex is about, that honoring.
Exactly. And the Sanskrit word is very helpful, that is in the central to my recent book, is urdhva retis. Urdhva means up blossoming, to blossom upward like a mm-hmm. seed blossoms upward into a flower. And retis
right.
means the seed. So it's the full blossoming of the seed. And that word points to what Tantra means. It's basically that the puberty is beyond what Freud mapped out. What we have in the West, it goes by the name of Tantra, is trying to take meditative principles, breathing practices, ways of looking at each other, eye-to-eye contact, but only up to the point of the genital puberty. Over and over mm-hmm. again, the farthest that some will go is the man should not ejaculate. So, but they don't say the positive side. What does happen? And this is the missing link, and it's the beginning of a huge amount of new information that is not widely out there, is it's not that the man doesn't ejaculate, so the sex goes on. It's that the hormones of testosterone and adrenaline and all the triggering chemistries, because you have to remember, it's an obvious fact, that every emotion should have a hormonal correlate. If
right.
you're happy, there should be a certain chemistry profile of the glands for that. If you're angry, you know, for each person.
You have adrenaline, yeah.
Exactly. So when you start to feel what a woman is from a man's point of view, your emotions are not just desire. Desire is mm-hmm. not a bad thing. In fact, mm-hmm. the only reason I have to say that is because Western religion for 2,000 years was sort of teaching that. That's why Freud mm-hmm. became helpful. But it certainly is not where to find out about truth, is in two great institutions arguing with each other. So in India, yeah, they weren't having to fight about whether sex is good or bad. They could just explore the potentials.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is, staying with the male point of view first, the male would see what a woman actually is, and the desire would keep changing to reverence, to play, to completely the connection with the fertility hormones of the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
likewise, the man's body and every all the bodies, the koshas, you start to see that this is not just your boyfriend or your husband.
Mm-hmm.
It's a manifestation of from the source. The DNA mm-hmm. is no longer DNA in some laboratory. It's like the equal to the looking at the crucifix if you're a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot just see it as someone dying on a cross. For Catholics, they think it is God. And so you
right.
look at a man from the tantric point of view, you see, we can't explain 1,000 generations of ancestors. Where does this mm-hmm. come from? You see it.
Right.
And likewise, the man. And so the fertility, the semen of the man changes. It, instead of developing from the testes and the prostate and all that, it mm-hmm. changes into other chemistries. This is what is very shallowly named male retention or carezza before that. It's not, the moods exceed it. And so that you don't come except the male side, except when you want to conceive a baby. Now, this is just one area of sex. Like I say, the sharing of the secretions and kissing mm-hmm. and oral cathedral worship, you get more and more of this higher, call it puberty, until it's very, very easy. And you're not talking about eliminating ejaculation or seminal retention or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like training wheels words. You're
right.
way into
right.
riding the two-wheeler with no hands. And both mm-hmm. people are helping each other. The female woman partner has a wide range of orgasms of the female, mm-hmm. including where the brain starts to gush, the pineal, mm-hmm. it's called amrita, and the nectars of the immortality, which I think are related to melatonin, because melatonin
right.
is natural chemistry that modifies aging and the human experience of time, which is exactly what
right.
the oldest scripture, the Rig Veda, was talking about, calling mm-hmm. it soma. So we're seeing
right.
definite correlates with the modern endocrinology. But when the couple mm-hmm. is sharing these through kissing, through the oral cathedral genital worship, through a type of intercourse that doesn't end, where you can't help but see the person as they look like the person you've known all your life, but they're more mm-hmm. than what you thought they were a minute ago. And
mm-hmm.
it's the most delightful. That's why I had to resort to poetry in my book. I just could not
right.
boil it down to a how-to. And
mm-hmm.
for the years where I first broke into this state, it was one of the more beautiful couple-year-long periods when I first broke into that state. And then it just keeps deepening and deepening. You just can't buy into,
mm-hmm.
I should say, what from your question, all of Tantra starts to deeply make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And some things, like I say, that the fertility aspect hasn't been well described. So how do you get fertility energy right now? People use contraception. They
mm-hmm.
block the fertility
right.
and
yeah.
the condom or the pills. And we're seeing in the legal system, how come these conservatives are so uptight about contraception? They have they're touching one part of the elephant of truth, that these hormones are sacred, but they don't know much more beyond that. So they look
right.
silly to the liberals. But they've got a point. And they're pointing to the higher Tantra that even in the Ten Commandments, where they say you shouldn't look at another woman but your wife with lust, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a pointer to meditation, that when people fall in love, like we were saying earlier, that's the only person you can think of. I think of
right.
the Turtles,
yeah.
rock and roll band from the 60s. It's only right to think about the one you love day or night, happy
yeah.
together. How is the weather? It's just, I quote a lot of rock and roll in my book to make
yeah.
it seem very near at hand. Yeah, you think about each other all the time because you're in love. That's what thou shalt not look upon another woman with lust. That's what Christ said. You not
mm-hmm.
only don't commit adultery, don't even think. But what he was saying is meditate on your beloved all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that
right.
happens when people are in love.
Yeah, and it occurs to me that we really don't understand this whole process as a society. I mean, at least in Western society, we truly are in puberty. We just don't get it. We don't get how falling in love relates to our greater relationship with the Creator and universal consciousness, and we're really just beginning to explore that. And we do have all these conflicts, like you said, the liberals versus conservatives, and it's we truly have a long way to go.
Exactly. You know, I think, you know, when you look at some of the gurus that came in the 60s and 70s, they certainly introduced the West to a different way of living. And now we have, what is it, 14, 15 million people practicing yoga. And it's a piecemeal transmission from one a whole culture to another culture. And India has, you know, has had its problems. We can't just ignore the issues that their culture has gone through. But at certain ideal points in time, it was working very, very well. And one of those times was about 150 A.D., when a very high-level, matured saint, some would say Shiva himself, was in the name of Lakalish, lived in west coast of India. And the caste system broke down, for example. That is a... The caste system was, based in reincarnation theory, and from time to time it gets rigidified. You know, even in an ideal culture, India, the teachings would say on planet Earth things are very wobbly. And then maybe that helps us grow, and we have to have these breakthroughs. But so when the saint arrives, it helps bring things back. And so the caste system, which had rigidified since Buddha's time. 500-600 years before Buddha had the same experience, he saw the caste system had gotten rigid and created Buddhism. We see it when saints arise. Christ saw that the Old Testament was no longer that useful. People, the eye for an eye thing was getting in the way.
Right.
And so you see waves of saints. Same thing happened in the 60s. We got some of the gurus, and they left a wave of teachings, and most of them got overwhelmed by the sexual liberation of that era, and we haven't had many gurus coming since then.
Yeah. Did you know that Jesus, when they come back,
will be furthered towards this massive cultural transformation. And some of these gurus will come from within America.
Yeah, I think that's true. Did you know that Jesus actually studied in India prior to his going into the desert? He studied in Ireland, in Egypt, and in India. A friend of mine, Trish McCannon, wrote a book on that, historically based. And so there's a lot more cross-sharing of the cultures than is really understood by, traditional religion. So he did study these principles in India.
I'd almost want to turn the tables and talk to you about that. Because I'm fascinated with this hidden history. One thing we know is that the whole university system of the modern world definitely traces back to the monastic system of the medieval era. And that
also
traces
the ancient
back
mystery
to India,
schools.
This is what he was doing, studying
in the mystery schools.
Yeah, and this ability to learn in a broader way began in the monasteries. And the monastic life was this intermarriage. It wasn't just celibacy. And a lot of saints were being born, and they were being required to, write down these texts one at a time. But it gave rise to the university system. So there's a hidden history about Indian culture affecting the West. I spent 10 years working with an Indian foundation that was trying to reveal everything from the zero, which was invented in India, to all kinds of metallurgy and ecological principles, like the tree worship. Tree worship in India, the Sanskrit word is D-R-E-E, dree. And when it made its way to Ireland and Scotland, it became druid.
Jesus went there with his uncle, who supplied tin to the Roman army, and Ireland was the place where they had all the smelting. The book is on Jesus's secret life before. It's got a long title, but it's Trish McKinnon in Hampton Road. She's been on Coast to Coast. I've interviewed her several times. She's actually a personal friend of mine. She lives here in Atlanta with me, and we share. My meditation group is also in her mystery school, so we've shared in each other's lives for almost a decade.
Well, I must say, you know, every time you say something, I really would enjoy interviewing you.
Great. Well, we are coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information once again for our listening audience?
You can reach me at Skype with STUART.Sovatsky, SOVATSKY, 1, or my email, STUARTCS1@comcast.net.
Well, we are at the end of our hour. I want to really thank you for joining us, Stuart. It's been a delightful conversation. And I want to remind our listening audience that sexuality is crucial to your health, whether or not you participate in it with other people or as we've been talking about this hour, that you have a different kind of marriage to a higher power through these practices. But in any case, repression of sexuality is something that has never turned out well for the people practicing it. So think about this energy and how it relates to your life. Stuart, thank you again for joining us. This has been Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. And next week we are, doing interviewing Dr. Kelly Turner on radical remission, surviving cancer against all odds. And then on the 19th of July, Diane Collins, Do You Quantum Think? New Thinking Will Rock Your World. Thanks a lot again, and join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.